Well, hello and welcome to BrianMadden.com, podcast number 141. I'm here today with my guest, Ojas Rege. Hello.
Hi, Jack. Good to be here.
Yeah, this is a really exciting time to be on. I'm happy to finally have you up here in the Tech Target office for the first time. As always, there's going to be a lot for us to talk about because I think any time we've gotten over on the phone over the years, I just like to nerd out about this stuff with you. But the reason why I invited you specifically here today is that you announced or posted on Twitter a few months ago that you were I'll let you describe the exact terms, but I guess you're stepping away from your day-to-day role at Mobile Iron. So the big question is, what does that mean for you right now and for Mobile Iron?
Well, it's been actually my 11-year anniversary of Mobile Iron was just this last weekend. So it's been an incredible time in my life. I always felt like Mobile Iron is like my fourth kid, you know, as if having three kids is not enough. Yeah. You know, there's a fourth. So I'm stepping aside. I'm going to be heading off to new adventures sometime later this fall. And so over the last couple of months, I've kind of parceled off the different things I was responsible for and kind of stepped back. And it's actually been kind of amazing to, you know, just look back at all the things that have happened in the life of the company, you know, at least in 11 years I've been there. And then the company was around a little bit before I got there as well.
Yeah, well, and so I also wanted to bring you up here because I think in the EMM industry, I don't think you need any introduction. I don't think there's anybody else in our space that has been more associated with being the face of one company, if not like the face of the EMM industry for so long and so consistently. Now you've done a lot of different things at Mobile Iron over the years. I feel like your title at Mobile Iron should have all just been. It's just Ojas. there's no need for anything else. But officially, you had several different roles, right?
Yeah. So when I started, the thing about early stage companies, of course, as anyone who's worked at an early stage company knows, you do whatever's needed. You know, you take out the garbage, you figure out your product, you go sell, right? All those different things. So a lot of us had a lot of different hats through the years. I mean, for me, the three primary hats I had. At different times were early days responsible for the product, so the first several versions of the product from a product management perspective, marketing overall, kind of establishing the category, establishing the brand at different points in the last 11 years, and then kind of a consistent view on just strategy, understanding how the category is going to evolve. I used to spend about a third of my time out in the field directly with our customers, because I've always felt that that's where all the good ideas come from, right? Is that type of engagement. But it's the fun part for me was always like you build something, but if no one uses it, then it ain't any fun. So how do you build something that people are going to use, and how do you get their eyes to open up to figure out all the things they could do with it? So I think it's kind of, you know, a little bit of inspiration, a lot of perspiration, as they say, but it's also a lot of communication to get people to understand what they could do with the tools they've got.
Well, and over the course of establishing the EMM industry. I mean, there have been a lot of conversations over the years, and that I've been part of them as well. When people just learning about the space, mm-hmm. just figuring out what is this EMM stuff about, what does it do, and as the IT industry and the at large was figuring out what does mobility mean. So I want to talk a little bit about the early days of that, especially. Like the days before I was doing this, because I've been uh-huh. following this space for about 8 years now. But if you wouldn't mind, I'm wondering if you can go back and tell me, first, like how you got into tech in the first place, and then how you got into mobility.
Yeah, it's been quite a fun journey through tech for me. So my first tech job was in 1985. I came out from Boston, where I was going to school, to California for the first time. And had a summer job at Fairchild Semiconductor, which was actually the granddaddy.
That's a distinguished
right?
name.
Yeah, of all of Silicon Valley. And
were you a hardware person then?
I was a software guy.
Okay.
So I was doing incredibly exciting things there, like, you know, converting COBOL code to Fortran and C and things like that. But you know, coming out from Boston, and I grew up in Canada, to beautiful California, I'm like, wow, I'm gonna go there when I graduate. So when I graduated in 88, I came out to work at Oracle. So what's kind of fun about that is when I started at Oracle in 1988, it's actually the size that Mobile Iron is now. It was about 1,000 people, about $200 million in revenue. It was the early days of relational database.
That's hard to imagine. I mean, Oracle has, you think huge.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it grew really, really fast. So it didn't stay that size for very long. But it was a fantastic experience for me. I think our average age worldwide at Oracle back then was 26. So it was all just young kids straight out of college with a couple of old ex-IBM sales guys, right? That's really what the company was. And it was exciting. And it was in a lot of ways like the genesis, I think, of a lot of the enterprise software companies in Silicon Valley, both from a cultural and a technology perspective. So that was the first taste of Silicon Valley tech for me.
And I'm guessing at the time, a relational database is such a huge leap forward that just like mobility today, or really mobility in the last decade and the internet in the 90s, I mean, that was, relational databases were the sea change of the 80s.
They were. And I think you'll definitely appreciate this, right, given the context of mobility, because you remember those early days in mobility where people weren't sure how to use it. Like, they weren't sure what the impact would be. There was a lot of evangelism. And then eventually the light bulb would go off and people would say, oh, I can do that. So that's what relational database was like in the 80s, because database was this boring thing, right, that was in the bowels of the organization, had all your GL and, you know, all your big data type, not big data the way we think of it, but all the data that no one really wanted to, you know, deal with, except the people who needed to on a day-to-day basis. And this whole notion that you could surface data and make it strategic, and even your marketing team and your sales team could use it, that didn't exist, right? And so Oracle and a couple of the other like innovative companies of that time, they were saying, hey, the reason this data stuff is important, the reason database is sexy, is that you're going to be able to actually impact your business directly. It shouldn't be hidden away. And that was a real eye-opener for people. I mean, now, of course, you know, think about all the companies. Everyone's focused on data, every software vendor and, you know, every organization. Wasn't the case back then.
Okay, so you're first at Oracle, that was the 80s relational database wave. How about the internet wave? And for fun questions, like, so what were the first things that you found or liked to do on the internet, or when you said like, hey, this thing is cool?
Well, you know, the first thing was so when I was an undergrad in Boston, you had all the news groups. Right. And a lot of the news groups and a lot of those things started where I was going to university. And so that was my first kind of connection with, wow, there's a broader, you know, society out there, if you will, I can connect with. But here's the thing about the entire internet boom in Silicon Valley. I completely missed it. So I went to business school and then I went back to the East Coast right before everything boomed here. So from 93 to 99, I was back on the East Coast working for a company called Boston Consulting Group.
Right, right.
You know? And so all my kind of compatriots who I was going to school with out here, they went to the early days of Yahoo and eBay and all this. And I was kind of looking at it from afar, you know, reading Red Herring and things like that, saying, oh, that's pretty interesting what's going on there. But that, that the internet boom for me personally, from a career perspective, was more, as an observer and trying to help at that point, really big companies figure out what the heck to do with it.
Right. Right. So at BCG, I imagine there were a lot of, like white papers and conversations and whatever, like, the internet is big now. What is your company's internet strategy? which, of course, completely parallels mobility is big now. What is your company's mobility strategy? And the realization that I had at one point is like, at no time in the last 15 years has anybody said like, what's our internet strategy? Because it's just like,
that's true. It's your strategy, right?
So just like I imagine, you know, I that we've had iOS and Android devices for over a decade now, and it seems like not too many people are asking, what should we do about this whole mobile thing anymore? So that's a bit of an aside, but So you're at BCG. What was next?
Well, actually, I wanted to, the point you just made, that triggered something in my own head, because you're absolutely right. So back then, the internet was happening. All these companies were saying, what's our internet strategy going to be? What's our internet strategy going to be? And same thing happened with mobile later. But what
should we go internet first
exactly.
on this product?
Yeah, like in 95, 96, I mean, you know, you might remember, like, people were asking even like basic things like, should we give email to our employees? What's the ROI of email? That, by the way, is a question that no one has ever been able to answer. What's the ROI of email? But you know, early days of any technology, people ask, you know, what's it gonna do for me, right? Which is legit. But what that triggered for me, though, is a great example, a great analogy that someone had given me for the web and mobile. So if you turn the clock, let's see, I think it was 95 that Netscape went public, right? Something like that, right? So that was kind of the beginning of the commercial web in a lot of ways. And if you turn the clock forward 5 years to 2000 or maybe even a couple years after that, you go to any company, any major enterprise in the world, really, but certainly America, and you ask them, do you have a web strategy? All of them would have said yes. And then you would ask them, well, what are you doing? And they would have been like, well, look at my beautiful website. Well, okay, so you took a bunch of your collateral and you digitized it. That's not a strategy. Did you change the way you interact with customers? Did you change the way you transact? That all took another 5 or 10 years. And mobile was a little bit like that. So if you think about mobile, when the iPhone first hit, so kind of post-BlackBerry, right? Because obviously BlackBerry had a very specific niche that it was focused on. But when the iPhone hit and apps became important, you know, 5, 10 years later, even now, 2017, 18, 19, you go to a company, every company is going to say they have a mobile strategy. But then you ask them, okay, how have you changed your business with it? There's still a lot that are going to be saying, hey, I gave people email.
Or their mobile strategy is like, well, we made our website responsive.
Exactly, which is really good. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But that didn't create competitive advantage. And to me, the key in any technology, whether it's mobile or AI or web or whatever else, is when does it get to the point in your organization where it creates competitive advantage for you, where you can compete better against your peers out there because of something you did? Because that's when it's got real value, right? Versus, you know, superficial value.
Well, yeah. And we can also say that, of course, we should distinguish between like the personal productivity advantages, because even if all my organization did was our mobile strategy, I'm making air quotes, was like, hey, we have a responsive website now, so that's our mobile strategy. The employee enablement, even
that's true.
For people that just sit around in offices today, we can't discount. I mean, even though we discovered it 10 or 12 years earlier when BlackBerries came along, we can't discount the importance right. of mobile email and now all of our other apps that we can get on mobile, even the basic ones like file sync and share and CRM and stuff. And I remember the days of our previous CRM system where you had to be on the VPN to use it. So sales reps on the road, they'd be calling back to someone in the office because they didn't want to go find a Starbucks and then turn on the VPN and all that. So there's that value that even if an organization isn't having a huge, like their customer facing part of their business isn't changing hugely because of mobility, it's still changing all of their employee experiences.
It changes behavior. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because in the end, what mobile primarily does, I think, is it changes behavior. It changes the way the data flows through your day and what you can do with that data. So it's all about latency. So and normally when people think of latency, they think of, oh, well, how slow the data is coming to me. But the way I think of latency is, okay, there's part of that, but that's not actually the real issue with latency.
Getting that push notification.
Exactly. Yeah, it's actually knowing something is there for you and having ubiquitous access, right? So that there is no dead time. So from the time that you need data or the time that you need to take an action to when you can actually do that is up to you as an individual, as Jack, not to someone else.
Right. There's a lot that we can talk about there. I want to go to the early days of mm-hmm. of how you did get into mobility.
Yeah.
Were you doing mobile related things before MobileIron?
I was. So this is my 19th year in mobility. And my first, I've been at three mobile organizations. The first was AvantGo, which was one of the earliest developers of mobile technology for consumers and enterprise. It was kind of a really unique moment in time, right? From 2000 to 2005, I was there. Sybase actually bought us.
And did you say that these were consumer facing?
What was really interesting is if you turn the clock back to 2000, there was only three companies in the entire world that built an HTML4 browser: Microsoft, Netscape, and AvantGo. And AvantGo's entire mission was, how do we take the web and bring it to, at that point, PDAs, right? Palm Pilots, you know, pocket PCs and so forth, Blackberries. How do we bring the web to these devices that have intermittent connectivity? So it was the notion of offline web. How do you take web applications that depend on connectivity and make them work offline? And what was interesting is, you know, we had an enterprise business. The whole business model was enterprise, but we couldn't get people to understand what they could do with it. So our founders had this, you know, amazing idea, which is, hey, let's create a consumer version of this so we can use it as a demo. And the consumer version became huge. And that was what people knew AvantGo on. That was how you got all of your consumer data on a PDA.
So that's like weather, sports scores,
New York Times, Wired, you name it, right? It was the, as Ken Delaney, who was one of the ex-analysts at Gartner, told me, you know, years later, it was the App Store before there was an App Store. It was the first true version of an App Store in consumer mobility in the U.S.
Then what was next?
So after AvantGo, Sybase bought us. I stayed there for a couple of years, and then I went over to Yahoo. And Yahoo was in a battle with Google, as everyone knows, back in 2005. And the one real incredible bright spot for Yahoo was what was happening in mobile. So we had an amazing mobile team at Yahoo. There was about 300 folks in the team. And every single mobile organization in Silicon Valley, consumer or enterprise, was seeded by the people who were in that Yahoo mobile team, what we called Connected Life, Yahoo Connected Life in those years. And that was when the iPhone kicked off, right? So the big aha for me when I was at Yahoo was just the impact that we felt the iPhone was going to have. We were lucky enough to be involved with Apple on the launch of the first iPhone.
And then, of course, on the enterprise at that time, enterprise mobility, it means running your Bez to keep your BlackBerry synced, or it might mean your Windows embedded devices, uh-huh, or whatever for your barcode scanners and such. The popular narrative, here comes the iPhone, and immediately there are questions of, is this can this be an enterprise device, or is this an overgrown iPod?
Well, actually, and for the first couple of years, it wasn't even a question, which is most IT departments said, oh, this is a toy, right? So, and in fact, that was what the other phone manufacturers said as well. I remember so clearly when the iPhone came out, because for the couple of years before then, we would go to all the other big guys, the Motorolas and so forth of the world, and tell them, here's the fundamental issues that you have with the experience you're providing. They'd be like, no, this is what the market wants. And then the iPhone came out, and then they all came to us at Yahoo, and they said, okay, we need an application that never requires a button. And things like that. So I actually think that what we see now in enterprise mobility, as I would argue most technologies now in 2019, 2020, the origination of the innovation and the origination of the behavioral change happens in the consumer landscape. Mm-hmm. And it drives the adoption of the enterprise. And that's absolutely what happened in mobile. Because when I think about mobile enterprise, back in 2009, 2010, there weren't a lot of IT organizations clamoring for it. Where it really started was the individual users. And luckily, it was individual users at senior levels in the organization who you couldn't say no to.
Yeah. And here at BrianMadden.com and at Briforum, I remember all the conversations about the consumerization of IT and shadow IT and BYO and what it means and how we deal with it. And it's interesting now. I want to go back to some of those presentations from 10 years ago and do like a pop-up video and an annotation of like, well, here's this issue that we were talking about and here's how it got solved a few years later. So I want to hear a little bit about the founding of Mobile Iron and how you got involved, because it's easy for us to see now, like, okay, the iPhone and Android came along and clearly there's going to be need for some MDM. And of course, it was iPhone OS 2 that got Exchange Active Sync support and configuration profile support, and then the MDM protocol came along in 2010, and that was of course a big moment.
Huge.
But there must have been some interesting times in those earlier days of just how do we create this entirely new space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I miss those early days in a lot of ways because every week something was happening in the market. So from a Mobile Iron perspective, the iPhone launched, and 3 weeks later in 2007, AJ Mishra, who is one of our co-founders, started the company.
So in iPhone OS 1, I guess it was just iPhone OS, there's nothing. No active sync. There's no configuration profiles. So what do you do,
right?
Like your MDM is a person that comes along and makes sure that it has a passcode on it manually.
Exactly. It's your mobile device manager is actually a guy walking around the hallway, right? Well, I think with AJ, he saw the future of the iPhone, right, in the enterprise before it had any capabilities to do anything. So and I'm speaking for him here, but when it launched, and I was at Yahoo at the time, and I felt this way too, both of us felt this is revolutionary. This is not just another phone, because we've all seen tons of phones. And frankly, Nokia had invented all this stuff like camera phones and so forth in 1999 anyways, right? It was the bringing it together. It was the experience. It wasn't the technology per se. And so AJ started Mobile Iron with the notion that there's going to be more stuff that happens. And he got Suresh, our co-founder, involved. And for like about 6 months, actually, from July of 2007 to...
Literally when the iPhone is just out for the first time.
For the first time, yeah. So for the first 6 months from then till January of 2008, they were really just the two of them thinking about what could the opportunity be. So they were just going out and talking to potential customers, IT. They were figuring it out. And then that's when Mobile Iron really started going, was the beginning of 2008 when we got our Series A funding, and I came on board just after that.
Well, and I guess there was also some precedent at the time, because at the time you also had Good Technology making their third-party email clients for other non-BlackBerry, non-iPhone smartphone platforms in around and before, and so there was that concept in market of like, well, we need an enterprise email client for this for this device. There was that approach. But then, of course, the iPhone launches without a third party app store, with no active sync, no configuration profiles. So was there much collaboration with Apple in those days? Like, did you know that hey, there are these technologies coming in the iPhone 3G that you can build off of?
Yeah. There was a ton of collaboration, and it's kind of neat thinking back to those days. So we started building the product, the Mobile Iron product, in 2008, and in 2008 you couldn't do anything on an iPhone, and Android didn't really exist, right?
Yeah.
So it was BlackBerry, Symbian, Windows Mobile, right? Those were the platforms. And then things started changing in 2009 because version 1 of Mobile Iron went live summer of 2009. That's when we actually launched the company publicly.
Mm-hmm. And so that's
3GS.
iPhone OS 3.
Yeah.
Without the MDM protocol, are you just telling people to download profiles? And
it was so basic. It was incredibly basic. It was really just, hey, go to this link and we'll show you applications that might be useful for you, right? There was no real way to do any type of configuration. But that's when our engagement with Apple started in 2009, because Apple actually, for them, the light bulb did go off. They had a team that realized that enterprise was going to be important. Maybe the rest of Apple didn't at the time, but certainly the enterprise team for iOS did. And so we started working with them. And I actually think that the original kind of design in 2009 and then 10, and of course the launch later in 10 that Apple did of the first set of MDM protocols was really elegant, because it was a way that no one else was thinking about it at the time. It was this notion that you can have a single source of truth, if you will, right? Single point of trust that you can rely on instead of multiple agents to be able to do configuration, application distribution, and so on. Now, a lot of stuff didn't come right away, right? It took a little while.
You mean like the fact that for iOS, there you don't need to have an agent to establish the MDM connection.
Right, exactly.
Just install that profile and it says, hey, your MDM server is here. And all of that is, it's just built into the operating system.
And the nice thing about that is it reduced variability of the endpoint, because I think that the big issue for security and for manageability is every endpoint is, there's one of the Gartner analysts gave me this analogy, I love this, which is you might think that every one of your laptops is exactly the same, but everyone's a snowflake. Right. Every single laptop in your organization is just a little bit different. And that becomes a mess. So, you know, it's okay to have the difference because you've got different applications and so forth, but you don't want to have that variability from a configuration perspective, right? Or from a security perspective. And so the underpinning of the Apple model was that we've got the agent on the device embedded that's going to manage all this stuff. You give us the server, you know, MobileIron or whoever else, and that's what IT is going to use to be able to do the right things so that their users get the services they need.
Right, right. And then, of course, at the same time, in the early Android days, I mean, it was also 2011 or 2010 that Android 2.2 brought the device admin API. But as we know, those pre Android Enterprise days were quite difficult. And even I can remember all the different times that being pitched different vendors that had their like custom flavors of Android builds. Obviously, Samsung Knox became the most prominent one, but that was a very, very active space for a while.
And, it really was.
And there was the 3LM effort to bring some unification to the management APIs that of course that never took off, and then thankfully we got Android Enterprise. But I know on my side, watching and writing about the industry, those were some interesting times. But I can't imagine, it just must have been massive headaches all along.
Well it was, and I think the challenge there was, it was the variability. It was very confusing for the end user, right? And by end user, I mean both the individual and the IT staff that was responsible for this in their organization. So I mean, I remember the evolution of this, because you know we launched our first iPhone support in September 2009. And then we had this amazing moment. I think it was April 10th, 2010, if I remember correctly, because that was the day that Scott Forstall and Steve Jobs announced iPhone OS 4, and specifically the MDM protocol. And the reason that that was so important is it was literally right before the first iPad came out too. Excuse me. The reason that was so important is that Scott mentioned MobileIron from the stage. And that was a company-making moment for us, because at that point, April 2010, you know, we had like 20, 30 customers. There was a little company no one's heard of. And suddenly, on the main stage of Apple, talking about the new version of, at that point, iPhone OS, MobileIron pops up, right? He mentioned MobileIron and Sybase. Those were the two companies he mentioned.
Yeah. I've seen that video, and I had forgotten about it, but now that you mention that, that's huge.
And that was mind-blowing. I mean, I think for any company, there's these catalyst moments. There's no way for me to overstate the importance of that moment for us as a company. It was just inspirational for us as individuals, saying, because we're working on this really hard. And of course, it was company making, because then suddenly people said, oh, so if I need do this iPhone stuff, I need this MobileIron. You know, who are these guys? Let me look them up.
Suddenly your website hits go way up.
Exactly. And that was part of the, I think, a lot of the work that we were doing with Apple and others were doing with Apple as well,
right.
coming to fruition.
But then you had the Android side then.
Yes, at the same time. Now, the challenge with Android, of course, you didn't have that singular person or organization that you could go to collaborate with, right? I mean, that happened later with Google, with Android for work, obviously, then Android Enterprise. But for a long time, and you brought this point up, it was so fragmented. So as a provider of these services, we were kind of stuck, which is like, you know, there's only so many engineers in the world. So how many different APIs can we possibly support?
Right, right. And the Samsung ones got big, but of course there were the Motorola ones and the LG ones. And
everyone had their own.
Dozens of others. Being in the product space, the life of a product manager is making difficult decisions about which features to support in which release. So I can't imagine how much time must have been spent figuring out which resources get assigned to which of these new APIs and everything.
Well, I think what it is all these big companies, they're going to say their stuff's the most important. And so it was really important for us to absorb that. But the key was to go to customers and say, what are you guys looking at? And so it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg, because when the MDM provider at that point supported it, the customer would start adopting it. But at the same time, we also needed to understand from customers what their view was. Like, do they really want us to support all 50, or are they going to go with one, go with two? And I think the answer is always the same, which is complexity kills, right? And if you're a IT organization who already doesn't have that much budget, you're trying to figure out what to do with all this new mobile stuff, anything which adds complexity to that mix makes it harder for you to deploy. And so it became really important for us and, you know, and others in our space to say, how do we buffer the complexity, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. How do we become kind of the layer, if you will, that reduces all the back end complexity so you as IT can go ahead and do the things you want to do? And what we ended up doing is we ended up supporting Samsung. We did a little bit of support for some of the other vendors, but the real push was Samsung had a play with a lot of our customers. We're going to support those capabilities that Samsung's providing and then really, really work and push Google to be able to take all of this and say, you know, this really needs to be part of the OS.
Yeah. And now the entire industry, we can all Android Enterprise. It's exactly what we want it to be.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is so now we're getting to the 2010, 2011, 2012 time period, which is when I first started as a full-time writer at BrianMadden.com. Very soon after I came on the job, one of the task was, hey, we're getting all these pitches about what to do about pesky BYO iPads and managing that. So why don't you go and figure out what's going on there? There was so little information about, you know, what MDM is and what it does out there. So I started spending all of my time doing that. But the two big things that I remember from that period of time is that was also when the mobile app management SDKs and app wrapping products first started coming along. So there were, I don't know how many thousands of MDM versus MAM articles must have been written in there, and there was that whole big conversation. But also a lot of people were still asking me, like, well, like, is this mobility thing? Is how big and how important is this going to be? I would be answering to people that were very skeptical of mobility and therefore also the need for mobility management. And you know, that was my earlier days of blogging. And then, like, well, there's stuff going on in the space. So
exactly. Well, I think any industry goes through phases. So if I was to think about 5-year phases that align with what you're talking about, from 2009, I would say, really to 2014, even though some of the app stuff had happened before then, but from 9 to 14, for the vast majority of companies, it was all about mobile email. It was just, how do I get email to work scalably and securely on my devices? And that was it. Very few companies, meaning enterprises, were going beyond that. And then from 2014, I would say, to now, so the next 5 years, is when people said, oh, wait a second, I can use these to also drive productivity. So productivity applications became important, right? The boxes of the world, the Office 365s of the world, all the kind of content, personal productivity types of things became important then. There were, during that last 5 years, a set of companies also thinking about transformational stuff, but I actually think it's only now that the real transformational stuff will start to happen in the enterprise for mobility. Not that some of it hasn't already happened, but each of those stages took two things, right, to drive to the next stage. One was the underlying technology had to be mature. So you had to be able to do applications effectively on a mobile device. You had to be able to distribute them effectively. You needed all those different application, you know, kind of toolkits and SDKs to feel comfortable that you were doing things securely, because otherwise you couldn't get to the apps. Once you got to those, then it became interesting to say, well, what's the next phase and so forth. But it took time. And mm-hmm. your memory is exactly right. 2012 is when we released our application SDKs. I think Good Dynamics came out around that time. There was a whole variety that came out around that same time.
Yeah. And I remember the fierce discussions and debates about whether or not to manage to MDM enroll BYO devices or to go at an apps only approach, and it's sort of you know, as the neutral blogger third party, I could say like, well, there are use cases that lend themselves to both approaches, and so the best bet is to be flexible in what you do. And there was a time when I sort of would have assumed that whole like, how do we think about and how do we do BYO debate or question would have settled down. And especially when Android Enterprise Work Profiles came along, we had another really interesting option there. And so I was expecting like, well, things are going to be kind of settled down there. But then I realized that like in that next 5 year set of time, like while that first 5 year set of time you were talking about, like the question was just figuring out email, and the question about how do we handle BYOD has still persisted to this day, and I've definitely over the 8 years that I've been doing this, I've become much more pragmatic than I was. I still see, I know and I see plenty of people that have separate work and personal phones, and 5 years ago I might have thought like, oh, don't you know about all of these different MDM and MAM and UE and management options. Today I'm definitely much more appreciative of the fact that fundamentally mixing the work and personal on a separate on a single device, like that was essentially an entirely new concept, mm-hmm. in enterprise IT, and it's always going to be difficult. And we saw like the question of how much you can allow a personal user to do, and then like as Android was getting more mature and typical consumers sideloading apps or rooting their devices, that wave of activity finally settled down. So you got to a point where it's like, oh, well, we can probably like legitimately say for a BYO users, like no rooting, no sideloading of apps. But then something like last year, Fortnite comes along and that an app is sideloaded, and suddenly like this is typical consumer behavior that you can reasonably expect that your users have a legitimate reason to want to be sideloading apps on their phone. And suddenly if your policy was no sideloaded apps on a BYO device that's accessing enterprise data, suddenly you have to reevaluate that policy again. And it, so that's one example of just how difficult this still is. And the other example that I wrote about for years is that after Android Enterprise Work Profiles came along and we saw all of the ways that they were doing, you know, all of the work and personal separation routes and all of the privacy protections, and we looked back at the Apple side and said like, hey, this really seemed like Android Enterprise was advancing that privacy concept a lot more than Apple was. And so for 2.5 years, I had this one article that I kept on like revising, it was like every year before WWDC of like, hey, here are the privacy concerns and such that we have with Apple MDM for BYOD. The big news this year for iOS 13 is user enrollment. And now you were mentioning earlier that you had to sort of stepped back from following like every single bit of daily news, but uh-huh. like to me, user enrollment it's like the most important MDM API change that we've gotten, you know, probably since Android Enterprise and since app management stuff in iOS 7. So. To me, this is huge, but...
It is huge. I mean, the way that I think about this, you absolutely phrased it exactly correctly, and I'm so glad you did earlier, which is that this whole notion of, I think of it as time splitting, right, between personal and professional on the same endpoint, this was a really new concept, you know, in a lot of ways, certainly at the level that it happens on mobile, like organizations and individuals had never had to think about that before. And I think so many of the issues that happened with BYO were not actually technical issues. They were issues of experience and trust, right? The experiential issue was don't mess my consumer experience up. And what you just described, which is, hey, if I can't download Fortnite now, well, you just messed up my consumer experience. So it's not just mess it up, like make it go slow, but just take away my choice, right? That messes up my experience. And then the other one is just trust. And this is something that IT never really had to deal with effectively until mobile came. Because until mobile came, IT was command and control, right? You're going to do what I want. You're going to use Siebel. You can't use something else. You're going to use this endpoint. You're going to use this PC. You don't like it. Too bad.
And by the way, when you're at work on your corporate PC, Facebook or whatever the
turn
big
on.
Consumer right. sites. Yeah,
exactly. We're not even going to let you get there, yeah. All that stuff. So mobile basically changed the power dynamic. And so there was two things that were happening. One is these new experiences were being created that people loved, right? That was key, and end users loved. And the power dynamic had now shifted, so the user was in charge. So the way I always thought about this, that the fundamental thing that the introduction of the iPhone did in 2007 for the enterprise is it made every individual, every user, their own CIO. Right, I'm going to pick the apps I want. I'm going to figure out the experience I want. I'm going to figure out when to use this and what version to use and which device I want and which operator I want to be on and so on.
Yeah, that's when we the term that my brother Brian used was FUIT. The Latin
exactly.
term for he or she or it was as an IT was in charge.
Yeah.
But now they are no longer. And if you need any help remembering it, you spell it FUIT.
Yeah, I remember it very well. And I think that created a cultural shift. And I actually think cultural shifts take way longer than technology shifts. So a lot of the BYO questions and issues that people had, the technical answers for many of them, at least 80-90% of them, were already there. And there's new things like user enrollment that absolutely help.
Yeah.
But the trust issue is really key. So how do I as an individual trust my IT department? And granted, you should, if that's an issue for you, there's other trust issues you need to have with your organization as well, because they have all your health records, they got everything,
yeah,
right? Your employer knows more about you than you would ever want to know. But trust on a mobile device is much more visceral. Right, because I kind of feel it right there and then. So I at least what I saw is this required IT to actually gain a whole new set of capabilities around communication, around experience, around engagement that they'd never had before.
There's also this realization that as I was alluding to earlier, that now that we've been doing this BYO thing for a decade, of you know what, there are some places where we just have to say no. And there were, you get questions of like, well, we have this sensitive application, and what if the user does this on their BYO device and we can't do this? And now more than 5 years ago, I'm much more prepared to offer the opinion that like, well, then that's probably not a situation where BYO should be happening.
Well, I've always viewed ownership as a red herring. So my view has always been that there was way too much focus on who owned the device. So leave that completely to the side and instead ask yourself, what are the functions the person's going to take on this device? What is the experience they need to have? What is the data they're going to have? And then regardless of who owns it, you're going to need the same privacy and security capabilities. Because if you've got confidential data, then you need security no matter who owns the device. But the converse is also true, which is a lot of companies thought I only need to worry about privacy on personal devices, and that's false, right? I mean, privacy becomes just as important for me to be able to manage effectively on a corporate device as a personal device. So I think that this was something that was new, this thought that ownership is one item, but it's really much broader than that. And I need to actually have privacy policy. I need to have a privacy model, a privacy strategy. GDPR made that a little bit more apparent to people, but that was a new thing for most organizations.
And now we've gotten into some very interesting places where we see things like the whole concept of an Android Enterprise work profile on a work managed device, saying that it's a work managed device, but even on this work managed device, we're giving you that that personal space on the device where IT has limited purview. So that's
very really important. The other thing, a big eye opener for me was many years ago we did this survey that really opened my eyes to a whole variety of these issues. We called it the trust gap. It was the Mobile Iron Trust Gap Survey. And it was not with Mobile Iron customers. We looked at what do individuals most worry about with trust, with their employer, with IT. And so it was looking at all the different kinds of elements of data that are on the mobile device. What do they really care about? And what the individual was really cared about was the things that, of course, were the best reflection of their personal life. So they really worried about their text messages. They really worried about their photos, right? They really worried about a whole variety of things. There's other things they worried less about, but very few organizations had actually gone to the end users and said, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we can see. Here's what we can't see. Here's how we manage stuff. Here's when we delete stuff. Here's when we don't delete stuff. And so there was really simple things like organizations helping their end users understand how to back up their personal information. So if the device was lost, that they could retain that and it wouldn't be something that now would be gone because the enterprise took an action.
We've certainly come a long way on all of this BYO stuff, and I'm super excited to see how user enrollment in iOS plays out over the next few years. One of the final topics that I wanted to talk to you about today is I think we can agree that one of the biggest buzzwords over a lot of IT is conditional access, zero trust, beyond corp. Pick your term, and I know the terms mean slightly different things, but we're all talking about a lot of the same concepts. And this is embodied in one of Mobile Iron's products, of course, Mobile Iron Access, and the industry at large is very into this term. And I think we can all agree that this idea of having knowledge of all of the context before an access decision made is very important, and the way that things should be. The interesting part about it to me, though, is looking back a little bit earlier and how at BrianMadden.com and in the mobility industry, we were focused on the device side of the things, while there were like early big players in the IDaaS space like Okta saying like, hey, you have all these SaaS apps, like let's introduce you to something called SAML. And like now it's so obvious that that identity and endpoint management come together to make this conditional access thing. Sometimes I wonder, like, if I had learned about this identity in SAML world at the same time as the mobility world, like it was just a completely different world. And I think, I don't know, I think what could have been, or would it have been possible for the world to come together sooner?
Yeah, no, I am 100% in agreement with you, right? Which is we can all kind of rationalize why the worlds didn't come together sooner, which is there's silos in vendors, there's silos in IT, but you're exactly right, which is in those early days, all the folks like us were looking at, we got this whole new generation of capabilities on the endpoint. How do we make it as useful as possible for end users, right? So there was, all of us were looking at that. And then you had another set of people saying, we got all these cloud services. How do we make those as useful as possible? So that second one was an access question, and the first one was an enablement and security question. But in the end, what is mobile? Mobile is the consumption vehicle for the cloud, right? And as I move all of this data off out of my data center, and now I've got it spread across what I think of as an information fabric, where I've got massive compute power, almost unlimited compute power in the endpoint, and all this unlimited compute power in the back, my data is not just going to be in the back, it's not just going to be in the front, it's going to be everywhere. And now suddenly, when you look back on it, it's exactly the point you're raising, which is the fundamental access decision has got to be based on context. And that a lot of that context is going to come from what the user is doing on that particular endpoint. So the world's absolutely come together now to make that work.
And I know some of the, in the early days, the question might have been like, sure, maybe we can lock down a mobile device to prevent users from accessing the certain apps. But what do you do when they just go over to their web browser and
exactly.
access those certain apps? And then, of course, we know that that identity management is a big part of that. It is interesting that it took a little while for those worlds to come together.
I think it's also the technology was evolving. So the way that I've always thought about this is your mobile device, that is your identity, right? But it's only now that we have biometrics and now that we have all of these kind of further identification mechanisms that we can make the device itself our identity, which would not have been as possible 5 years ago.
Yeah, FIDO is the buzzword.
Exactly.
Everything is as Fido over the last over the last even 6 months since Google announced FIDO certification for Android 7 devices and above. And this has just been a huge time for that. And Kyle Johnson and I have been spending a lot of time in that world.
And it's a perfect storm right now, because what you see is you see the evolution of cloud services and the evolution of traditional identity at the same time that you see the evolution of these mobile experiences and the evolution of biometrics. And so now I get to the point where I can legitimately change the way that I've thought about authentication in a way which I think organizations would have liked to in the past, but it was never actually feasible, or it didn't hit enough of the use cases for it to matter.
So here's the thing. I look at what's happening in what has happened in mobility and what's happening in identity and authentication and how they're coming together in this whole conditional access world. And I see that as like, this is an ultimate realization of all of the things that we've been talking about, at least since as long as I've been in the industry. And I guess I must not have the greatest imagination, because like, obviously it's going to take a long time for all of that to fully come into place. But today in 2019, like after you solve for those questions, I have a hard time knowing exactly like what's going to be next. Like some people say, oh, like it's going to be wearable devices, but really wearable devices, it's just like another, like we're already used to managing a bunch of different types of devices, wearable devices. It's just one more to plug in. And even like machine learning, and like the talk these days, like 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, people were starting AI companies. But today, you don't start an AI company. You have like a product that happens to use machine learning underneath it. So it's like already going to be like, okay, this is an application logic thing that will enable our higher level applications. So like, is that going to have the big wave of effects on end user computing the way that mobile and cloud did? And it seems like, well, that's like more of an application logic level thing. So like after this,
what's next?
Yeah.
We solved all the problems?
Yeah.
You know, it's always easier to have that conversation in retrospect, right, than in advance. But, you know, I think that in the end, it always comes back to you just look at an individual. And in an enterprise context, you look and see, how does that individual do their work? And where are the barriers for them finishing a job? Where's the latency? All these things that we talked about before. And the aha always happens when the way that that individual does their work can fundamentally change. So that's what mobile did. That's to some degree what cloud does as well, though I think mobile's more important from a behavioral perspective for what a user needs.
Yeah. And we know that machine learning can be used to create applications that can do, we see with computer vision and translation and all sorts of applications that have made generational leaps and bounds thanks to machine learning.
I mean, I think that I don't know what the solutions to these problems are, but I think that there's a couple of key challenges that users have. Even if they have ubiquitous computing in the form of mobile and cloud, which is one is they just have too many apps. Right. I mean, we kind of get a little bit of app overload, and you get a lot of your data and a lot of different applications, and it gets challenging to be able to utilize things as efficiently as possible. So I think at some point you get a little bit of app overload in the enterprise context. And then the question becomes, well, what's your system of record for data? And can I get to that effectively? And is the interface that you give me? And I do think there's a next generation interface that at some point will be required in mobile to be able to do that effectively.
And is that interface and of course the physical manifestation of an interface can be on a touchscreen, it can be text, it can be a conversational UI, it can be voice, and those are kind of different questions. But
I think it'll be a mix.
Like when you mentioned the question of too many applications, I spent like 30 minutes last week looking for one file in email box, Dropbox, Google Docs, and it ended up being in my other Google account. And that exactly typifies that problem. And so is the answer there, maybe it's like the digital assistant agent, it's like Siri, if it has access to all of those different repositories of information, if there's something there that I can say, like, this is what I need to do, or this is what I need to get done, help me with the integration of all these different steps and processes. And I it seems that, like, usually that's like, sure, that sounds great, but it's like, okay, this app doesn't expose to Siri's APIs right. properly, and like, will we always be facing that issues?
I think you might be to some degree, but the bigger problem, I believe, is there's two that to me, if we could figure out how to solve as an industry, would have a huge impact. One is the discovery issue. That's what you were raising with, I've got a file and I don't know which of my file folders it's in, right? I mean, and your folders or folders, quote unquote, are spread out across all these clouds. So there needs to be a new discovery model for an individual that takes away all the pain. That's one.
Right now, my discovery model is whichever piece of glass that I have in front yes. of me that I have to manually tap around or click around to find anything.
It's kind of like, you know, you lose your sunglasses, so you're opening every closet in the house. Did I leave them in there? Did I leave them in there? Right.
Versus you have like a tile or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Or someone just says, oh, yeah, I'm sure you left them there. And the second thing, which is also related to this, is I think there's a next generation of display models. So there's a new discovery model and a new display model. And the way I've always viewed mobile devices, and this is not a new idea by any means, is this is my compute that I take along with me, but I should be able to use that compute with multiple different display mechanisms, right?
Well, I'm looking here on my wrist at my Apple Watch. That's it's all the same data and all the same apps that are in that mobile device.
And yeah, exactly. And sometimes I need bigger displays, but I can't cart those around. So, you know, not to get all Minority Report and so forth on this, but I think that these two are really key problems to solve. Now, what is the commercial benefit? This is always the challenge, which is what does the enterprise software company, you know, sell to do this? I think a lot of this needs to come from the Googles and the Apples of the world, which is how do I provide maybe a mechanism to provide better discovery at the endpoint into backend services? And then services will have to adopt some of these technologies as well.
Is that a Google Assistant, Cortana, Siri, Alexa type?
It could be related
task.
To that. Yeah, and this is where, you know, in the end, a lot of this comes down to the good old-fashioned API.
Yeah.
Right. Which
yeah.
is how are the what is my data exchange mechanism? What is my do I have a data discovery standard? Because once I start having individual encryption and separate encryption models in all these different services, data discovery becomes really hard, especially when I go cross service.
Well, also all of these services that have an incentive to stay closed
exactly.
and to the number of times like there are lots of great integration features in mobile operating systems, and any app that breaks those discovery features deliberately, maybe they're breaking universal links, or they don't use them when they could, or it's frustrating. But these different app makers have that economic incentive to
protect,
keep everything in their sandbox, so that the pessimist in me gets frustrated by those problems, and maybe the answer is, do I put enough trust in my like ultimately the way to get into this data is through the UI. So if I have Siri or Alexa or whatever, and maybe there's a like a user agent option that it's just like, screw it, we're going in through the user interface, and as the user, I say, like, I trust this agent to go in on my behalf. Maybe something like that is the answer.
Well, I think certainly all the creators of those agents are really hoping that is the direction that people go. I will say
like,
one thing, though.
Like if, like on a desktop operating system, you can make a script that'll click buttons on pages and apps. And I know on, how did Samsung make an acquisition of a company that could do something like that they started, that they built into their provisioning process or something like that. But so far on iOS, there's nothing that you can have go click on things for you unless you have one of those little robot hand things.
But the other part of this is that I do think these are all things, discovery, display, kind of next gen stuff that could have an impact. But I still, though, when I step back and I look at what companies are doing, enterprise doing with mobile today, I truly believe it's still early stage for most organizations. For, you know, 80% of folks out there, they're still very tactical. So there's still a lot of huge transformational impact that they can have just by thinking about mobile as a way to fundamentally re-engineer their business processes, regardless of whether there's a broader discovery mechanism.
Employee-facing or customer-facing or both?
Well, I was thinking employee-facing. Customer-facing as well, but customer-facing happens faster because the consumer landscape moves so fast. So I kind of feel like there's a natural snowball effect customer-facing, but there's not necessarily a natural snowball effect employee-facing in a lot of organizations because customer-facing drives dollars, right? It drives top line usually.
Yeah, yeah.
But employee facing a lot of times feels like a cost, even though if you do that right, as we all know, it has massive customer facing implications.
I can't wait to see what's next because I think of in so many organizations where my job it's emails, it's documents, it's spreadsheets. I would love like some of those spreadsheets to be turned into like dashboards that answer a lot of the questions for me in the background. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but that point that you raised, I think a lot of companies are looking at, which is I was talking about display, more physical display, but data display and data presentation and data mm-hmm. consumption. Ends up becoming just visualization. All the different elements of visualization are a key element of where a lot of innovation could happen. And here too, I think we need to look at the consumer landscape. The thing that I've always believed from day one of mobility 20 years ago is enterprise mobility is not as hard as people think. You just got to look and see what's happening in the consumer landscape, see what's working there, and that immediately tells you what interaction models, what consumption models, what data models are liked by or preferred by the end user, and then you take those and you bring them into your product.
So, like when we see that, like Slack and Teams being an integration point, that analog would be social networking apps. And...
Well, yeah, exactly, because every one of your users learns how to use mobile and their expectations are set by the consumer applications that they use. And so I've always told our customers, you're not building employee-facing apps. Don't think of them as business apps. You're building consumer apps for your employees, right? And they need to be just as good as the consumer apps those employees use in their personal lives. Otherwise, they're not going to use them. And they need to have a similar interaction model to what they see in their personal life in order for them to adopt them and get value from them.
Right, right. So, and that's exactly what I thought when Workplace by Facebook came out, because everybody already knows how to use Facebook.
Yeah.
And there was some, let's just say there was some skepticism about the idea of a Facebook for work. But of course, intranets and other enterprise internal social networking apps have been around for a long time. And so that's an interesting space as well. So these productivity questions and what this future is, we could definitely go on for a long time. But the last thing that I want to ask you for today is, as you're stepping back from your day-to-day role at Mobile Iron, can you tell us anything about what you're doing right now or what you're thinking about or even how you're spending your time and what you think is interesting right now?
Well, definitely. It's been nice spending time chatting with you on the podcast. I certainly appreciate it. And it's nice to finally do this, actually. So I have been spending, and this is separate from mobile a little bit. This is just something that's been going on in the back of my head. I've been thinking about how do you cut through all the hype of AI into some of the really foundational questions that exist there. And those to me fall into a couple of categories, but the two that I have particular interest in is data ethics. So to me, data ethics is going to become one of the big problems of our time because we're going to have all these AI and machine learning systems and they will be operating on data with built-in bias. So if there's a way for me to identify institutional bias in my data sets, the impact of that from a business and a societal perspective will be huge, right? Otherwise, I'll institutionalize biases and make the wrong decision. So that's kind of one side of it. And then the other side of it is how do I take all of these new data crunching mechanisms that every cloud provider in the world wants to give me and all their ML algorithms and all this great stuff, right? And how do I actually leverage that to do one of two things? One is to create better experiences for the end user, right? This is some of the things we've been talking about. How do I make those experiences more intelligent? And secondly, can I now apply these to some of the more kind of foundational issues that we're running into in the world? So things like climate adaptability and so forth. So mobility is, in my mind, the primary consumption vehicle for all this stuff. And I really think, and I feel very gratified that the world now is in a position where we don't have to think anymore about, oh, you know, should this thing be available in a mobile device? No, mobile is actually going to be the primary. So that's there. It's got lots of innovations still left to have. But in 20 years, we've gone from mobile being this thing that, you know, a couple of salespeople had to being a thing that actually drives and controls in a lot of ways our lives, right, or that we rely on.
Just like internet and email before
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's great. So now then the question is, well, what's next? What are the next set of applications and the next set of capabilities we can apply to that based on the massive scale that we get in the back end to be able to do something that really matters?
Well, well said. So with that, we'll wrap up the podcast and thanks so much for making the trip up to San Francisco. I know it seems like you've, judging by your Twitter, you've been like going to a lot of concerts with your kids.
And, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of good like music that. In San Francisco.
a lot of fun stuff going on. Well, like I said to the readers and people in the audience, with the mobility industry, I think you need no introduction. So I think there will be a lot of people that will be really excited to hear what you do next.
And I also want to thank you, Jack, because over the last 8 years, the work that you and the team have done have had a huge impact in getting the right questions on the table, both to vendors and to customers, and really help build the category into something that matters, right? Because in the end, the only reason you write, you know, software is because you want it to matter. And you and the team have made a big difference there. I really appreciate the work you guys have done.
Oh, thank you very much. And with that, thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been the BrianMadden.com podcast. Until next time, happy travels, and thanks again.